this morning. We thank you for your great love for us. We thank you for your word that speaks into our lives and changes us. I pray this morning that as we look at your word, it will change our lives, that we will see that you are the God who is in control. And we just thank you for your son, Jesus, who makes it all possible. Amen. So this morning, we are continuing in Ecclesiastes. And does this sound really funny to you? Okay. All right. So how about if I just talk with my normal voice? Can everybody hear me? Oh, let's try this mic then. Good morning. Can you hear me on this mic? Okay. Wait one sec. Let me negate the mic behind me. Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. We're on. All right. Haven't done this before, so it's going to be interesting. I can still hear the rattle. Can everybody else? Okay. All right. How about if I just use my normal voice? It's better with the mic? Okay. All right. So this morning we're going to continue our study, and we're going to... He begins by doing a series of comparisons in chapter 7, and I'm just going to read the first 10 verses. It says, "A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of feasting, for death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Frustration is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. It is better to heed the rebuke of a wise person than to listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. Extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. The end of the matter is better than the beginning, and patience is better than pride. Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. Do not say, 'Why were the old days better than these?' For it is not wise to ask such questions." And I think as you listen to that, you could see that some of them you could figure out. I mean, they were quite obvious. He's saying a good name is better than somebody who looks really good and maybe isn't good. And so a good name is important. It's important. And the day of death is better than the day of birth. Now, I don't know, but when somebody's born, what are we all doing? That's right. And when somebody dies, we are mourning. And so that one was a little harder to understand, except that when I went down to verse 8, it says, "The end of the matter is better than the beginning." And I think that probably Solomon was thinking that at the day of death, everything is over. All the struggles are finished. You've completed your life, and there is hope beyond that. At the day of birth, you have no idea what's ahead of you. I think you've probably noticed, as we have been in Ecclesiastes, Solomon is really concerned about several things. One is he's very concerned about death, the fact that he's going to die. He's very concerned about the fact that he has no control over the future. He is very concerned about the injustice that he sees in the world. And so I think he says that the day of birth is not so, isn't better, because there is just a lot that you might not see in the future that you don't know about that might not be good. And he says it's better to go into a house of mourning than to a house of feasting. And as I thought about that, I realized you're less likely to get into trouble in a house of mourning than a house of feasting. So he's probably just talking about that. That's, I think, quite evident. And then I think he says that frustration is better than laughter. And actually, I think in terms of accomplishing something, that is a very true statement. I don't know how much has been accomplished through frustration, But I think a great deal, because it is when we are frustrated that we look for a solution to the problem. I am sure many great things have been haven't you ever been doing something and think, oh, I just wish somebody would invent a better way to do this? I don't know whether you have ever, so when I was in public school, there was a Board of Education meeting at the end of the year, and what the grade 8 students who were not having any trouble in school had got to do was collate all these pages, and we walked around this table for about 2 hours picking up pieces of paper and then putting them all neatly together and stapling them and starting all over. Wow, somebody obviously got frustrated with that, and now there are photocopiers who do that for you all by themselves. So frustration does lead to good things, and I think it does. And it says that the heart of the wise is in the house of the morning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of pleasure. And I couldn't help but thinking as I read that one about the Beatitudes, and it was, blessed are they that mourn. And what he's talking about is those that mourn for their sin, who recognize that they need a Savior, that they have a problem in their life. And I think he's probably foreshadowing that in that statement that he makes. And the end. And then I want to just read this, because this really gave me some thought. It says, extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. And that's obvious. The end of the matter is better than the beginning. And I wonder if this is where that phrase comes from, the end justifies the means. Because sometimes we think we need to do something that we don't think is quite right to get the result that we believe is right. And so sometimes people bribe or use extortion to accomplish what they think is good. And so I think maybe that's what that was. But it took me a while to figure that out, because in reality, in one sense, the end of a matter is better than the beginning, because you've got it accomplished. It's done. I don't know if you're a check your box type, but tick, 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 it's ticked. All the problems have been solved. You know, there's a sense of accomplishment and peace when you get to the end of a matter. But if the way you got to that end of the matter was, if you saw that the end was obviously the best and that you had the best solution and that's the end you wanted, you could be tempted to get to that end by wrong means. And we know that's not the right way to do it. Patience is better than pride. Yeah, I don't know how you ladies are with patience. I'm not the best. And as I read that, I realized that sometimes I'm not patient because I think I have the best way to do something and somebody else isn't doing it. My way. The right way. The correct way. And pride is the issue. When I read this, I thought at first, oh yeah, that's an obvious one, Lord. And then the Lord just kind of said, oh, well, why aren't you patient? Oh, yeah, I have the best solution. No, not necessarily. That's pride. Sometimes we don't have patience because we are a little bit too proud and think we know what's best. And, you know, I have to tell you that that's a characteristic in others I don't really like, that they're always right. In my house, if your last name is Woolsey, you're always right, even if you're wrong. So I'm not a Woolsey, I'm a Hall. So I have 4 Woolseys in my house, and you put my husband and 3 children together, and they're all always right, even if they disagree. And they're still having the last word as they are separating. Just a warning. I thought I didn't have that characteristic till I thought about it. Be not easily provoked. Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit. Wow, that's a hard one. Because if we're easily provoked, then we get angry. And we know that anger does not bring out the best in any of us. I think more forgiveness is required when we have been angry than almost anything else that we do in our lives. It is our mouths and our tongues that create sin. And so we need to not be easily provoked. And then he says, do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. How often do we say, it was better before. It was so much easier before. Everything is much harder now. Well, you know what? That's grumbling. It doesn't change anything. And you know, I think when I was in high school, we talked about learning from history. That is only true if you choose to learn and change. You do not learn from the past if you choose not to recognize what you need to change so that you are not in that position again. I had a very wise friend who said to me when I was dealing with someone who was in a crisis, she looked at me and she said, Marjorie, that person was in that crisis 5 years ago, exactly the same one that they are in today. And I'm telling you, if you solve that problem, 5 years from now, they will be in exactly the same spot. Because the only thing that will prevent it is a choice in choosing to allow God to bring about the change that is required so they are not there again in 5 years. And, you know, there we go, a little bit of pride in there. Like I thought, well, you know, maybe. But she was right. I have, over the years, observed that people are often in exactly the same spot they were not 5 years ago, but 20 years ago. And if you ask them what the problem was, they would tell you. And if you ask them what they needed to do to change it, they probably could tell you. But they are not willing to make those changes that are required. And so we need to realize that we can look back at the past only if we are going to learn from it. Or only if we are going to deal with it. Helpful to look back in your past at sin and ask for forgiveness. Helpful to look back on your past and set relationships that were wrong right. Helpful to look back on your past and see where you could change and make the outcome, if that situation happened today, to be a godly outcome. Often good to look back, especially when I think about anger. Oftentimes what is triggering the anger that is occurring right now is something that has nothing in absolute terms to do with what has just occurred. It is something in my past that has happened and I have not dealt with it. Absolutely beneficial. But it is not beneficial to look back at the past and say, if only. Because that doesn't change anything. And it's not helpful to look back at the past and think it was much better than today. Because really, we have really short memories. And really, the past isn't nearly as lovely as we think it was when we were living it. We've just looked back and blocked out the negative and kept the positive. And so I think, by and large, that Solomon was right on with these. And then he goes on to talk about wisdom, and that's one of his favorite topics. Unfortunately, mainly he is talking about human wisdom. But human wisdom still has advantages. We would really like godly wisdom. But if you're going to have a choice between human wisdom and foolishness, and folly, it's probably better to choose human wisdom. And he says, human wisdom is like an inheritance. Like an inheritance is a good thing. And benefits those who see the sun. And it's funny, mine has sun spelled S-U-N, but I realize that really wisdom benefits us when we see the sun spelled S-O-N. Wisdom is a shelter as money is a shelter, but the advantage of knowledge is this: wisdom preserves those who have it. And so he has really reached a wise conclusion in that sense, that when we make wise decisions, we are less likely to end up in trouble, to end up in a mess. So wisdom does have benefits. But then he goes back. He goes back because he's looking at the world and he doesn't actually see all the benefits of manly wisdom, man's wisdom. And he says, consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future. So he acknowledges, I realize I haven't been clicking this because I'm holding the microphone. Back one. God is in control in the good times. He's in control in the bad times. I'm just going to read a little bit further in this. I have seen both of these, the righteous perishing in the righteousness and the wicked living long in the wickedness. So he has seen that God is in control when righteous perish and suffer and when the wicked live a long time. And you know, if we look at the world from man's wisdom, we would have to stand here and say, it just doesn't seem fair, does it? It doesn't. But we need to know that God is in control, because it doesn't matter how we feel about it. We cannot change anything. And his favorite topic is the future. And he says we can't discover the future. There are lots and lots of people who spend lots and lots of money trying to discover the future. I don't know about you, but I don't want to know about the future. The only future I'm interested in is heaven. Do you really want to know somebody to tell you that your husband's going to die tomorrow? Or you're going to have a car accident or whatever? Do you really want advance warning? I don't. I'm willing to live for today. In fact, my family would probably tell you that I'm the type of person that lives for today. So when people often talk to me about the past, I'm kind of like, I don't dwell on the past, and I don't look to the future other than to plan in a sense of general plans. I live in the present. That's my personality, and it's not everybody, so it's just part of who I am. But the reality is I would not like to know the future. And I am so glad that God is the one that controls the future. And he knows what's going to happen in my life 1 hour from now. He's going to know what I'm going to say in the next minute. He's the one that's in control. And I'm really thankful. And I'm thankful that Solomon acknowledges this in this passage when we're looking at it. He acknowledges that God is the one in control. And then he issues some warnings. He says, do not be over-righteous, neither be over-wise. Why destroy yourself? Do not be wicked, and do not be a fool. Why die before your time? It is good to grasp the one and not let go of the other. Whoever fears God will avoid all extremes. Actually, my Bible has a note, and it says we'll follow voice both, and I think that's avoiding either. Wisdom makes one wise person more powerful than 10 rulers in a city. Indeed, there is no one on earth who is righteous, no one who does what is right and never sins. Do not pay attention to every word people say, or you may hear your servant cursing you, for you know in your heart that many times you yourself have cursed others. And he's saying, don't be self-righteous and conceited. He's not saying don't be righteous, because you can't be over-righteous. You're either righteous or you're not. So the reality is there are lots of
times we are self-righteous. I talked about always being right. Well, you know, we're conceited. I'm better. We compare ourselves to others, and we look good. And so we become conceited and self-righteous. And he says, and don't be wicked or foolish, because that's wrong too, and we know that. That's a little bit more obvious. But what he is saying here is that you need to not be self-righteous and think you are great, nor be wicked and think you're great. Because, you know, there are lots of people that are wicked that think they are great. We think they should think they are wicked, but they don't. Because if they really thought they were wicked, they would probably not do what they're doing. So they probably think that the wise are fools, because they're doing what is right, and the other guys think they're having a better time. Wicked seem to think they're having a better time, which we know is not true, but they might think that way. And so he once again reminds us that it's better to be wise than to be foolish. And then he quotes, he says, indeed, there is no one on the earth is righteous, no one who does what is right and never sins. And that reminds us of Romans 4:4, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And so it's a reminder that we were all sinners. We might like to think we aren't. The self-righteous probably think they are, but they aren't. We're not righteous, none of us. And then he goes on to say that you shouldn't pay attention to every word I would have said to you and about you. And I thought his point was perfectly, just hit home to the very core, my very core, when he reminded me that sometimes I say the same thing about other people that they're saying about me. We need to, especially when someone is angry, not excusing anger, by the way, but when someone is angry, when someone is PMSing, when someone is overtired, when someone is grieving, that sometimes they say things they wish they had not said. And we need to be gracious and forgive them and acknowledge, not condone what they have said, not condone any excuse, but to recognize and forgive. Because we have all been angry, PMSing, overtired, and grieving, and have said things we wish we hadn't. And it's just a reminder that when we are looking at others and have an unforgiving, unkind, hard attitude, that we ourselves have probably been in that situation and done similar things, and therefore we need to extend to them the grace that we would like them to extend to us. And as chapter 7 comes to a conclusion, he talks about the fact that men's wisdom cannot explain everything. He finally gets it. Men's wisdom just doesn't explain everything. It doesn't matter how hard he tries, how he applies it, how he looks at it. It doesn't work. And then he talks about how it's hard to find anyone who is upright. And he's already said that there's no one, so I'm not sure why he's looking. I think women probably take a little bit offense when he says, I found one upright man among 1,000, but not one upright woman among them all. Well, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. So I'm not sure how he even knew any women, really, other than in quick passing. Well, I'm sorry. That, you know, you do the math. That's 3 years of one-night stands, a little bit more than 3 years of one-night stands just in those women. So I have a feeling that he probably didn't know very many women other than in a physical manner. Anyways, he says that. And then he talks about how the fact that wisdom actually does change us. He says, a person's wisdom brightens their faith and changes its hard appearance. So wisdom is worth having. Godly wisdom, I would stress. He was talking about man's partly, but I think maybe he was talking about God's by the time he got here, because he acknowledged man man can't make sense of it. That doesn't mean he doesn't stop trying to use earthly wisdom to solve it. And then he does a total change in chapter 8. And he talks about obeying the king, so obeying government. And he says, obey the king's command, I say, because you took an oath before God. And that doesn't really apply in Canada. We don't take an oath of allegiance. But in the United States, children in the morning at school, am I right, take an oath of allegiance every morning. We don't do that in Canada. Yes, Sherry? Yes, if you become a Canadian citizen, if you're born, we don't have to do that. Weird. But in lots of countries, you do. You swear an oath. All it means is really that you are a citizen of Canada and committed to the country in which we live. And so he says, you should obey the government because you're really part of the country that is being governed and you have a right. Do not be in a hurry to leave the king's presence. Do not stand up for a bad cause, for he will do whatever he pleases. I thought that was interesting. Stand up for a good cause, but don't stand up for a bad one. The king might still choose to do whatever he wants, but make sure it's not a bad cause you're standing up for. Since a king's word is supreme, who can say to him, what are you doing? We're so blessed we live in a democracy where we have a little bit more say. Whoever obeys his commands will come to no harm, and the wise heart will know the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and a procedure for every matter, though a person may be weighed down by misery. Since no one knows the future, heard that before in this book? No one knows the future. Who can tell someone else what is to come? As no one has power over the wind to contain it, so no one has power over the time of their death. His other favorite topic. As no one is discharged in time of war, so wickedness will not be released those who practice. And it goes on. And it's saying we need to obey the government because we're citizens of the government. I want to stress here right now absolutely that you should not do something the government tells you if it contravenes God's law. It is never an excuse. Actually, I was listening to a disturbing discussion on the radio, and someone's response to a question was, it was in the book of procedures and I did it. It was morally wrong, but because it was in the book, I did it, because I'm who I am and I had to do what the government said. That's not an excuse for sin. It is not an excuse to do things that you know are morally wrong or unconscionable. And I want to stress that that is not what I am saying this morning. But as a general rule, the government very seldom asks you to do that. And so as a general rule, we should obey the government. And the other reason is not just an oath, is because the government has the power to make you. In most cases they do. And then he says it's a good idea to obey the government because it's wise. We don't know the future. And it might seem like a weird request, provided it doesn't contravene God's laws. But we don't know the future, so we don't know how God is going to take that situation and use it. And so we need, because we don't know the future, to trust that God is in control and obey our governments. And we can't control when we die. And so he's talking here a little bit about battle and war. And I was reading Ray Stedman's commentary on this, and he talked about the fact that he was drafted and he chose to serve. And he came back alive, but some of his friends didn't. And he talked about the benefits that he received with the GI Bill of Rights. Doesn't happen in Canada the same way, but in the United States, for years, if you had served in the military, they would pay for your education when you got out, and it paid for him to go to seminary and begin his ministry career. But he said when he signed up, when he responded to the draft, he did not know the future. And he was a little bit hesitant about doing what he was asked. But he followed it, and he could see God's hand as he went through it. And then he reminds us, and I'm not going to read that passage because I'm running out of time, that wickedness is real. We talked in our group a couple of weeks ago, and I was saying how thankful I am not the leader of a country that has to make a decision when to intervene somewhere else, when horrors are happening. I said then, Richard Chamberlain is most famous for the words, "Peace in our time," after he met with Hitler. He was probably a great guy, but those were the wrong words. Hitler was evil. And there was no peace, and there couldn't have been peace. We look back and we think, well, maybe they should have negotiated. Well, some tried, and the result was not what you wanted. We need to realize that there is wickedness in the world, and it needs to be dealt with. I'm just thankful that I'm not the one that has to make that decision. But we need to be prayerful when our governments and world leaders are making decisions and not judge them based on the knowledge we have. Because history has often proved us wrong, that real wickedness did exist. That's not to encourage countries to invade other countries or whatever, but it is an encouragement to acknowledge that sometimes there is wickedness and evil in the world that needs to be dealt with and stopped. And so he says, that's why you should obey the government, that those things are valid. But then, of course, he says, well, you know, that's kind of meaningless, because what occurs on the earth are the righteous who get what the wicked deserve and the wicked who get what the righteous deserve. This, too, is meaningless. And he's, again, coming to that conclusion that life, from our perspective, does not make logical sense. I often say, I'm so glad when I get to heaven and everything will make sense. I'll get it. And someone pointed out to me that when I get to heaven, I'm going to be changed and I probably won't care. There you go. And then he comes back to the conclusion that we have heard repeatedly in this book. So I commend the enjoyment of life, because there is nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them in all their toil, all the days of the life God has given them under the sun. And if we went back to chapter 5, we would see that it says in chapter 5, when he's making a very similar statement, moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them and to accept their lot and to be happy in their toil, this is a gift of God. So he's not saying eat, drink, and be merry. He's saying God is the only person who's able to make you have joy. And that we should have joy in what God calls us to do, because it's what he's calling us to do. And then he finished up by saying, no one can comprehend what goes on under the earth. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know it, so we're always right, they cannot really comprehend it. And so he's come to the conclusion that man's wisdom is inferior to God's, and we will never make sense of things, no matter how hard we try. And actually, I thought that was really interesting. Stephen Hawking died just recently, and so I have a degree in sciences. And so I was reading what his latest book is, and I just stood in awe of the fact that even as he was dying, he was still trying to make sense of something without God. And I don't know about you, but when I was in school, electrons were the smallest particles. Now there are quirks and quarks, and I'm sure there's some smaller than that. He decided that we have a finite there are a finite number of universes. instead of an infinite number. And nobody has quite figured out yet how the Big Bang Theory happened. We just have to take that for granted. But anyways, it was just interesting just to read a bit of what he had decided as he was dying. And I just thought, really? God did it. Makes it much easier. Do I understand how he did it? No, but he knows. And as I looked at this passage this week, I thought, God knows the past is over. We cannot change the past. No matter how hard we try, no matter how much we wish, no matter how much we twisted and chain and put a better spin on things, the past is over. We need to deal with it, but we need to leave it in the past because we cannot change what we said. I wish I'd just ever been in a discussion and thought, oh, if I'd only said this, I'd have got my point across. You can't go back and do that. You can't change the past. You can learn from the past in the sense that it can change you. You can allow God to have the power to change the things that you have done wrong in your past by forgiving. You can allow God to change you so that you don't commit the same things, you don't do the same things, but really you cannot change the past. The present is all we have. Right now is all we have. I don't know how you have felt as you have over the past few weeks, as there was the bus crash in Humboldt, there was a shooting in downtown Toronto. I am certain, in fact, one of the hockey players that survived said he had just put on his hockey gear in the bus to get ready to go to play hockey. And I thought the farthest thing from his mind was that when he would wake up, he would be in a hospital bed. One minute he was driving in a bus, and the next minute he was in a hospital bed. And the next minute for 15 of them was they were dead. The 16th died later. And I'm sure that in downtown Toronto, when those, well, it was a little bit, not quite downtown, but in Toronto, when those people headed out, left work, went from their house, whatever they were doing, their thought was not that I'm going to die. And I don't think we should live with that thought that I might die right now. But what it should do is make us enjoy the moment we have. If we lived as if every moment was our last, how would it change what we were doing and saying and thinking? And God is the only one who knows the future. And he is in control of it. And there is no point in wasting your good present minute worrying about tomorrow. Because you might be on that bus that has no tomorrow. So leave that in God's hands. That doesn't mean I don't make appointments and I don't plan to meet people and plan to have coffee and look ahead and think, okay, you know, this is happening. I need to make good preparations and plans. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about worrying about tomorrow. Because tomorrow might be your day in heaven. And we need to realize that. And we need to realize that God is in control. He was in control in the past. He is in control today. And he is the one who holds the future. And it's because we know him, and because we love him, that we can face tomorrow with confidence. Because without God, we have no confidence in tomorrow. Whether our tomorrow is here on earth or whether our tomorrow is in glory with him, he's still in control of tomorrow. And so I would urge you this morning to deal with your past and then leave it in the past. Don't spend time thinking if only, what if, maybe I should have. Leave it. Leave the future in God's hands. Don't worry about it. Not saying don't make plans, just don't worry about it. Live each moment enjoying what God has given you in that moment and going forward, because he's the one who is in control And he knows what tomorrow's going to come. And he's not going to give you what you need for tomorrow today. He's going to give you today what you need. And tomorrow he will give you what you need for tomorrow. Let's pray. Father, I am so grateful this morning that you are the God who is in control. I am thankful that you know my future and that it is held in your hand. I thank you that I can go forward today because of that. I thank you for the moments and the minutes and the seconds you give us. I pray that we will each of us use them to bring glory to your and honor to your name, and that we will appreciate what you're doing in our lives. Even in our sorrow and our grief and our pain and our hurt, you are there in the midst, and you are giving us the peace and the ability and the wisdom to cope in those situations. And in the great times when we're excited and great joy, you're there. And you're the reason we have that joy. And you're the reason we can have that joy in good times and in bad. And help us to stop trying to figure out your job and stop trying to do your job. And allow you to control the future and help us to live in the present. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.